Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. Those of you who read newspapers in the morning will see yet another article in today's press about the selection of judges, alleging that strange people have been appointed to the bench and complaining about the lack of transparency in the selection of judges. So it's a very topical subject. When we decide to deal with the subject in this series, we don't muck about. We go right to the top. And we're extremely privileged today to have no less a person than Sir Gerard Brennan, former Chief Justice of the High Court. You can't go any higher than that to give us a presentation on that subject. Please welcome him to the podium.
Well, thank you for your introduction, and I'm pleased to be able to say that you can't go any higher than the Chief Justice of the High Court. There was a time when that wasn't always so. I should like to commence by acknowledging the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, and indeed all Indigenous peoples of this country, in this place which represents the Commonwealth of all peoples. This subject, the selection of judges, is a subject of constitutional significance. I address it from that viewpoint. Nothing I say refers to any particular judge or group of judges. But the process for appointing judges is unstructured, and the criteria for making appointments are not defined. To quote a discussion paper issued in 1993 by the Attorney General's Department, little is known publicly about the appointment process, and no established internal rules for selecting judges have been developed. The appointment process has varied according to the personal preferences of individual attorneys general. Now, if we are to review the process of selecting judges, we should understand why we appoint judges and the functions which they are appointed to perform. Then we can consider the qualities of the women and men who should fill the judicial offices of the Commonwealth and the best means of selecting them. Donald Horne said that the first of the civic values which most Australians would share is maintenance of the rule of law. It protects peace, order and progress. It is the basic underpinning of a free society. It is a value which is never questioned, and in the political arena, it is sometimes invoked to justify particular measures. But is what is meant by the rule of law? It means that the state, by its institutions, gives effect to the legal rights and duties, powers and immunities, which affect relationships between people and with government. Implementing the rule of law requires a definition of those rights and duties, powers and immunities, and a coercive mechanism to give effect to the law in particular circumstances. In a democratic society, it is the function of the judiciary, separated from the political branches of government, to define the legal rights and duties, powers and immunities to which effect is given. In the familiar words of Chief Justice Marshall in Marbury and Madison, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. In a democracy which respects the separation of powers, the courts are the responsible institution to enforce the law as defined in concrete situations. In totalitarian societies, on the other hand, the legislature might retain the power to interpret its laws. The repositories of state executive power are authorised to enforce the law as they see it, without judicial supervision, and the judiciary is directed to decide cases in accordance with state policy. Well, now, experience elsewhere and our own history have shown that that kind of self-regulation is incompatible with the rule of law. The rule of law means the law as defined by independent and impartial courts is applied by the judiciary or under judicial supervision. We should be clear about how judges implement the rule of law. The rule of law is not the same as rule by law. It may be that Nazi Germany was ruled by law, many of Hitler's heinous policies being implemented by courts which applied laws framed in accordance with the prevailing ideology. The rule of law, on the other hand, seeks to do justice according to law. The judge is not a juridical robot. He or she may have to make value judgments in which common sense and an appreciation of community standards play a part. Was the defendant negligent? Was the conduct dishonest? What are the best interests of the child? What is the appropriate sentence to impose? Sometimes, particularly in the higher courts, a judgment has to be made on more technical and complicated issues. Do the facts attract one rule of law or another? What is the meaning of an ambiguous statute? Should an earlier precedent be distinguished in the present circumstances? How should I exercise my discretion? A judge's active participation in the process is an integral element in, an essential characteristic of, the rule of law. In a secure democracy, public confidence in the judiciary is critical to the rule of law. That is, confidence in the selection of the best judges available and confidence in their competent and impartial application of the law. Both the public and the existing judiciary have a vital interest in the process and the outcome of selecting judges. In my paper, I describe in broad terms what judges do and the qualities they need to do it. Those qualities include knowledge of the law and skill in applying it, competence in controlling court proceedings, analytical skill and ability to express reasons for judgment, industry, strength of mind, independence, and the primary judicial virtue, impartiality. I emphasise the different courts call for different judicial talents. The process for selecting judges should not impair the safeguards of judicial independence. An aspirant to judicial office, and even more, an aspirant to judicial promotion, should have no incentive to speak or act in any way that might advance the aspiration except by the resolutely professional discharge of her or his professional duties. In other words, the ideal process is one where the only relevant consideration is whether the candidate has and has demonstrated the professional ability and the independence and impartiality of mind that is required for the performance of the judicial duties in question. A judge must be not only able but willing, once the judicial gown is donned, to shed any predilections that might affect either the conduct of litigation or the judgment to be delivered. And a judge must remember that judicial impartiality or the appearance of judicial impartiality can be affected by inappropriate conduct or associations even outside professional life. The very authority of the court depends upon the demonstrated impartiality of its judges as well as on their competence. Now, if men and women with these capabilities and capacities are the judges whom we would wish to see appointed to our courts, how well suited is the present process of selection to discover and to appoint them? In this country, we adopted without much reflection the process which, over the years, had been adopted in England for the appointment of judges. We entrusted judicial appointments to the uncontrolled and unreviewable discretion of the executive government. True it is that, in general, the power has been wisely exercised, and Australia has been privileged to have judges who, with very few exceptions, have been competent judges possessed of the judicial virtues I have mentioned. The respectful aura with which the judiciary has been traditionally surrounded encouraged the public to expect, and government overall to satisfy the expectation, that judges would be appointed on merit. But in reality, there have always been exceptions. And recently, there has been an increase in the number of anecdotal reports of unmeritorious appointments. The time has passed when it is possible to have any confidence in the system to discover and evaluate the abilities and the character of prospective appointees to Commonwealth courts. In earlier times, when the only Commonwealth courts were the High Court the Bankruptcy Court and the Industrial Court, when the Attorney General of the day was an experienced and distinguished senior legal practitioner, a Menzies, an Everett or a Barwick, for example, and when the judiciary was drawn from a bar much smaller than it is today, it is possible for the attorney perhaps to know personally and certainly to ascertain and to form adequately an appreciation of the relative merits of possible appointees. That is no longer the case. Certainly an attorney, a minister or an Attorney General's department can take soundings from their friends and acquaintances, as well as canvassing the views of serving judges, bar associations and law societies. However, a professionally inexperienced attorney or a ministerial colleague or a government department is unlikely to have an appreciation of the actual functioning of the particular court, or to be able to examine critically the respective merits of all possible appointees. The number of Commonwealth judges has increased greatly in the last 30 years, and candidates for judicial appointment can now be drawn from fields other than the practising bar. The jurisdiction of the Commonwealth courts has expanded into new fields of law. Commonwealth appointments are no longer restricted to the High Court or to what are known as the Superior Commonwealth Courts, the Federal Court and the Family Court. In 1999, the Commonwealth Magistrates Court was created with a jurisdiction that is both extensive and important. Appointments to that court are likely to attract less attention than appointments to the higher Commonwealth Courts, even though appointees will be exercising the judicial power of the Commonwealth in diverse areas, including family law, bankruptcy, migration and industrial matters, issues which affect the vital interests of individuals. It is impossible for the executive government to form a view of the comparative suitability of candidates for judicial appointment without extensive and relevant consultation and informed advice. That should be structured. The public interest is not served by appointments made upon advice, at least some of which may come from secret sources. 30 years ago, Sir Garfield Barwick, then Chief Justice of Australia, saw the problem clearly. Even though there were fewer judges on only three courts to be selected from a smaller pool of possible appointees. In the first State of the Judicature address, he said, and I quote this at some length because I don't think the values that he has expressed here have changed in the intervening years. In my view, the time has arrived in the development of this community and of its institutions when the privilege of the executive government in this area should at least be curtailed. One can understand the reluctance of a government to forego the element of patronage which may inhere in the appointment of a judge. Yet I think that long-term considerations in the administration of justice call for some binding restraint on the exercise of this privilege. I make bold to suggest that in all the systems of Australia where appointments to judicial office may be made by executive government, there should be what is known in some systems as a judicial commission. The nomenclature is unimportant. A body saddled with the responsibility of advising the executive government of the names of persons who, by reason of their training, knowledge, experience, character, and disposition, are suitable for appointment to a particular office under consideration. Such a body should have amongst its personnel judges, practising lawyers, academic lawyers, and indeed laymen likely to be knowledgeable in the achievements of possible appointees. Such a body is more likely to have an adequate knowledge of the qualities of possible appointees than any Minister of State is likely to have. I respectfully agree. I agree with the reasons he advances for the creation of a judicial commission. Similarly, in the United Kingdom, the Lord Chancellor, Lord Faulkner, in a paper issued by the Department of Constitutional Affairs, wrote this: in a modern democratic society, it is no longer acceptable for judicial appointments to be entirely in the hands of a government minister. For example, the judiciary is often involved in adjudicating on the lawfulness of actions of the executive. and so the appointment system must be, and must be seen to be, independent of government. It must be transparent, it must be accountable, and it must inspire public confidence. Well, years after his first State of the Judicature address in 1995, in his book A Radical Tory, Sir Garfield pointed out the real risk of the present system in politicising judicial appointments. Left to politicians, he said, the appointments are not always made exclusively upon the professional standing, character and competence of the appointee. At times, political party affiliation, or at least an expected affinity in judgment to the philosophies of the party, forms some of the criteria for choice. Sometimes party political considerations are the dominant reason for it, even to the point of choosing the appointee merely to resolve a possible threat to the leadership. When experience of judicial work in a particular court is limited, and there is an inability to form an adequate opinion about the comparative merits of particular candidates, there is a greater likelihood of favouring those with political or personal connections, irrespective of their experience and ability. In 1999, Justice Bruce McPherson, then chairman of the Judicial Conference of Australia, contended that there is growing evidence that the power of making judicial appointments is coming to be regarded by governments as a form of patronage and a source of influence that can be used to serve their short-term political interests. The Honourable Jeff Davies, who, as our chairman has pointed out, has been in the paper this morning on the same subject, speaking with the experience of a state solicitor general, leading advocate, and sometime judge of the Queensland Court of Appeal, notes that the traditional practice of consultation about judicial appointments with a view to appointing the most suitable candidate has changed. This is what has changed, he said. Attorneys do not always consult with those professionally able to assess the professional qualities of candidates. When they do not always disclose the names of possible appointees whom they have in mind. And they do not always accept the advice of professionals that a person they have in mind is not professionally qualified for the specific judicial position. He observes an increased politicisation of judicial appointments because, and I quote, politicians appear to have come to believe that there are only two kinds of judges, those who are on their side and those who are on the other side. Now, if there be any doubt about the accuracy of Jeff Davies' observation, the recent statement of the present Commonwealth Attorney must have dispelled it. The Honourable Philip Ruddock, with insouciant disregard of recent history, is reported to have said that the most noticeable feature of the current approach for appointing judges is its accountability. He praises the existing practice in order to count any proposal for a judicial commission, a proposal which, in the Attorney's eyes, and I quote, is the judicial activist's last frontier. They see that the numbers of conscious judicial innovators is drying up, so want more of a say in picking future judges. Well, now, those comments must come as a surprise to the bipartisan members of the Senate Standing Committee on Legal and Constitutional Affairs in 1994, who, noting the element of mystery attending judicial selection, made these recommendations. First, that criteria should be established and made publicly available to assist in evaluating the suitability of candidates for judicial appointment. Second, that the Attorney General for the Commonwealth should establish a committee which would advise him or her on prospective appointees to the Commonwealth Judiciary. That committee should include representatives of the judiciary, the legal profession, and the non-legal community. And thirdly, they recommended the same thing for the states. Well, as Jeffrey Davies observed, things have changed. We have heard that recently prospective judicial appointees have been interviewed by the Attorney General. We do not have access to any record of these interviews, but are left to speculate on what may have transpired. Public questioning of a nominee, as in the United States, may be unacceptable, but secret private questioning of potential appointees is a denial of transparency in the process, especially in light of Sir Garfield Barwick's warning about political criteria in the making of appointments. We saw the ambition to exercise raw political power when Mr. Tim Fisher called for a capital C Conservative to be appointed to the High Court. What a disservice was thus done to the High Court. Politics becomes the dominant consideration in judicial appointments when governments seek to wrest court judgments to their own purposes, or when patronage is to be conferred on friends or the party faithful. It is high time that politics, which need not be taken out of consideration entirely, is subordinated to the requirement of merit, competently assessed. Unless that is achieved, the reputation and authority of appointees will be questioned, and public confidence in the impartiality of the judiciary will be diminished. There's a further justification for reviewing the present method of selecting judges for Commonwealth courts. Apart from the exercise of a court's jurisdiction, some judges are called on to exercise non-judicial functions, especially under modern legislation, which often enlists judges as personae designatae to perform what are essentially executive functions. Now, I'll go on to describe some of those functions which are subject to judicial control and sometimes subject to appeal established courts, such as the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, the issue of warrants for the arrest of persons accused of arrestable offences. But then there's a change that's come over it. With the passage of anti-terrorism legislation, however, the persona designata arrangements have been significantly extended. Judicial officers, serving or retired, are now enlisted to issue warrants for detention and questioning, to make orders extending the periods of detention or questioning, and to preside at and supervise the conduct of questioning sessions. Moreover, these powers are not now reposed in all members of a court or a tribunal. They are conferred only on those judicial officers selected by the Attorney General or by regulation. Judicial control of the exercise of these powers is difficult, if not impossible, to invoke, even though the involvement of judicial officers is intended to give an assurance of balance in the circumstances of each case. This gives a new relevance to the question of the appointment of judges. The Attorney General is the minister charged with the administration of the anti-terrorism laws, having power to authorise applications for warrants to the judicial personae designatae. He has the authority to select the judges on whom anti-terrorism powers are conferred. Does not this arrangement open the way to the appointment of at least some judges who might favour too readily the exercise of the anti-terrorism powers at the expense of personal liberty? The arrangement appears to saddle an attorney with at least a reasonable suspicion of conflict of interest. It tends against continuing to allow an Attorney General a non-transparent, non-accountable role in selecting judges. Overseas. Australia is one of the few nations whose national government has repelled a proposal for more transparency in the process of selecting judges. The United Kingdom enacted the Constitutional Reform Act in 2005, which set up a Judicial Appointments Commission. The Act addresses the two aspects of judicial selection that affect transparency and objectivity: the constitution of the authority to make a selection and the criteria to be used in the process. The Act provides a mechanism for selecting a candidate for appointment to judicial office, even the highest. The selection of the highest appointments is advised to the Lord Chancellor, who notifies the Prime Minister, who must recommend the person selected to Her Majesty for appointment. Similar arrangements are made for those lower in the judicial order. The Act provides the selection of judges is to be solely on merit, and the Commission must be satisfied that the appointee is of good character. But subject to these requirements, the Commission must have regard to the need to encourage diversity of candidates. Of course, those are rather broad criteria. Much depends on what is included in the notion of merit and what blemishes are consistent with the retention of good character. Well, the Commission has developed five core qualities and abilities which are required for judicial office. They are intellectual capacity, personal qualities, an ability to understand and to deal fairly, authority and communication skills, and efficiency. Now, with each of these headings, they embrace particular qualities which the Commission has gone on to define. For example, intellectual capacity has been said to include high level of expertise in the chosen area of profession, ability quickly to absorb and analyse information, appropriate knowledge of the law and its underlying principles, or the ability to acquire this knowledge where necessary. My paper goes on to review the main features of the judicial appointments process in Canada, South Africa, New Zealand and Israel. I omit the United States because the systems are well known, but neither the direct election system, which is incompatible with our Section 72 of the Constitution, nor the system of public examination of a candidate by a Senate Judiciary Committee seems to be attractive to most Australians. Possible models for Australia. The experience of other jurisdictions is informative. Most common law countries, and I've dealt with each of those that I've mentioned, have been conscious of the need to make the appointment of judges more structured and objective in order to achieve three principal objectives: building and maintaining public confidence in the judiciary, removing political influences that might impair the selection of the most qualified candidates judged on merit, and, subject to the necessity of appointing candidates on merit, expanding the categories from which judges have hitherto been appointed. I should not have thought that an improvement in the process to achieve these objectives would be undesirable in Australia. The principal disadvantage, in the eyes of some, would be the elimination of political patronage, a price that none of the main political parties has thus far been willing to pay. But there is little integrity in paying lip service to the rule of law while we cloak in secrecy both the criteria and the procedure for appointing the judges to whom the task of enforcing the rule of law is entrusted. Of course, any reform of the present practice must conform with Section 72(1) of the Constitution. It provides that the justices of the High Court and of the other courts created by the Parliament shall be appointed by the Governor-General in Council. This provision precludes any system which would allow any authority other than the executive government the power to make a federal judicial appointment. However, academic opinion seems to favour the view that Section 72(1) merely identifies the appointing authority, and that a law prescribing a process of nomination by a Judicial Appointments Commission would be valid. Certainly no constitutional doubt has attended the enactment of Sections 7 and 8 of the High Court of Australia Act, which govern the appointment of High Court justices, including the requirement for consultation with State Attorneys General. Assuming the validity of a law which would regulate the process of appointing federal judges, the proposals of the Senate Committee earlier cited may be taken as a starting point. The first one: that criteria should be established and made publicly available to assist in evaluating the suitability of candidates for judicial appointment. This has been done in the United Kingdom, Canada, and New Zealand. It can be done here. Criteria have two advantages. They provide a public assurance of the quality of judicial appointments, and they focus the attention of referees and members of any selecting authority on qualities that are relevant to the selection they are to make. As in England, the development of the criteria should be the function of a Judicial Appointments Commission. The criteria relating to legal ability would reflect the jurisdiction of the respective courts. This is of particular significance in the selection of justices of the High Court. Although popular comment and governmental interest might emphasise the legal ability of a candidate in public law, a large proportion of the High Court's work is in private law, not least in dealing with the burden of special leave applications. This part of the Court's work attracts little attention, but justices with broad experience are needed to assist in a massive and varied caseload. Next, the Senate Committee recommended that the Attorney General of the Commonwealth should establish a committee which would advise him or her on prospective appointees to the Commonwealth Judiciary, and that committee should include representatives of the judiciary, the legal profession, and the non-legal community. A Judicial Appointments Commission would give structure to the process of selection, and with satisfactory drafting of the legislation, would restrain executive governments from the making of unmeritorious appointments for political or personal reasons. Differently constituted selection committees of the Commission would be needed for each of the Commonwealth courts, reflecting their respective jurisdictions and administrations. The third recommendation about such a commission for the states is outside the scope of this paper, though the considerations which warrant a Commonwealth Commission would have much force in the states. While preference for different models of a Judicial Appointments Commission will vary, one model could be based on the general framework of the United Kingdom Act, with the necessary adaptations and some variations. In 2006, two distinguished academic lawyers, Professors Simon Evans and John Williams, presented a well-researched paper to the Judicial Conference of Australia. The authors proposed a Judicial Appointments Commission based on the English model, but with some variations. I agree with the basis of their proposals, but I would prefer a model with some different variations from the English template. I would therefore suggest this. In the first place, while the United Kingdom provides that the Chief Justice of a court should preside on a selection committee for her or his court, a Chief Justice of a Commonwealth court might find the relationship with an incoming judge more difficult if the Chief has participated in the selection process, especially if it became known that the appointee was not the candidate favoured by the Chief Justice. I should prefer to allow the Chief Justice to appoint a nominee to the selection committee if she or he so chooses. Now, for the High Court, for example, a selection committee might be composed of, first, the Chief Justice or nominee, second, the Attorney General of the Commonwealth or nominee, third, President of the Australian Bar Association or nominee, fourth, President of the Law Council of Australia or her nominee. Next, two non-legal members appointed by government who are familiar with the work of the court. And finally, a person of distinction chosen jointly by the Chief Justice and the Attorney General. It should be mandatory for the selection committee to consult the Attorneys General of the states and territories, each of whom should be entitled to submit one or two names which the selection committee would be bound to consider in settling the list of nominees for submission to the government. A selection committee for a court other than the High Court should be somewhat differently composed, as each of the judges of those courts is based in a state or territory and discharges a majority of her or his duties in that state or territory. It would be preferable to include the local rather than the national presidents of the professional bodies in the selection committees. In the next place, the United Kingdom Act strips the Prime Minister and the Lord Chancellor of any ultimate power to decline to accept a selection. In Australian conditions, and with an eye to the provisions of Section 72(1), it is preferable to leave the ultimate choice to the executive government, but not without some restraint designed to ensure that merit is the prime consideration. The selection committee should submit a list of, say, three names from which the government is invited to make the appointment. If the government wishes to consider another person who is not listed, the Attorney General should refer the name of that person to the committee with a request to reconsider the list. The committee would then include the name in a new list of three or inform the attorney in writing why the listed name is not preferred. If government nevertheless proposes to appoint the person who is not listed, the Attorney General should inform the committee in writing of the government's reasons for appointing outside the list. Now, this is not a coercive sanction, but it provides a sufficient incentive not to appoint an unlisted candidate for dubious reasons. Finally, as appointments to the High Court are usually made from the ranks of serving judges, it would be invidious to publish communications between the selection committee and the Attorney General about the relative merits of candidates. The same view could be taken about appointments to other courts, but for less cogent reasons. Now, those are my personal preferences. There may be variations on them, of course. The conclusion. Governments no longer have the means of making an informed judgment about the comparative merits of possible judicial appointees. A more structured and informed process is needed, a process which allows for the views of an informed public to be taken into account and which yields appointments measurable against stated criteria. The efficiency of the courts is enhanced by the appointment of the most competent and impartial judges available to serve. Thus, public confidence in the courts is maintained, and thus the rule of law is protected.
Thank you very much. We have some time for some questions. Could I ask any questioners to go to the microphones if they could, so that their questions can be recorded?
Thank you very much. Chris Klugman, Civil Liberties. Thank you very much for that address. I found it quite inspiring and very thought-provoking. It brought to mind the recent Thomas case, and I wondered if you would comment on that, where the findings of the various judges appeared to reflect more their attitude to the terror laws than any other aspect. I wonder if you had a comment on that.
The brief answer is no. But I should explain. It has been a great privilege for me to serve as a member of the High Court. I do not think that it is any function of a retired member of a court to comment on the work of her or his successors. And for that reason, if for no other, I would not comment on the judgments in the Thomas case. There's another reason. Apart from the media reports, I haven't read them. But that will take a little time. Perhaps when I'm finished rereading Gone with the Wind. The case is obviously an important one. The only comment that I would make is not in relation to that case, but with regard to the problem that we have with the anti-terrorism laws, and that is the problem of the absence of, not in that case, but in other cases, problem of the difficulty of ensuring judicial review of decisions which are obviously of importance to the safety of the community, but which are of no less importance to the liberty which we're trying to defend.
Any other questions? Could I ask you to go to the microphone, thank you.
To the microphone and the column, sorry.
Perhaps I should stand up here, so it might be easier.
Sam Murthy. Thanks very much. This is my first experience to come and listen to such a honourable and educative lecture. My question in this context is, sir, you have mentioned the public confidence and public assurance almost 23 times so far, the importance of appointment in that context. Now, my question is, given the change in world, particularly towards terrorism and the perception of security by the general public, how do you think the balance should be met in terms of executing a law as well as maintaining the public confidence? Because if any perception of not following the law in terms of detrimental effect to the public is going to be come back to the judiciary again if you get it wrong, so how do you balance that?
I have been very happy to come and speak today on the question of the process for selecting judges. I have pointed out one aspect of the developing law with regard to anti-terrorism in that context. The question of how to balance the security of a people against their civil liberties is, I think, a question of enormous importance. It's one which I must say that I would not here wish to enter upon. And it's not because it's not important. It is of vital importance in my view. But it does need a particular inquiry into the specific provisions that have been enacted, the difficulties of their operation, and the significance which each provision has, both for the security of the country, the ability to provide any possible system of safeguard, and the availability of judicial review. In other words, I think the problem is a complex one, and I wouldn't wish to give, as it were, a broad sweeping off-the-cuff, over-the-top view about that.
Sounds like a job for a Senate committee, maybe.
I'm Michael Breen. My first question is almost petty, which is, what actually are those permissions for leave which you mentioned? And the second question is, you've spoken several times about the loss of confidence in the legal system. May I naively ask what that implies and what are the effects of that?
Could I have your first question again, please?
The first one was, you said that one of the functions of judges was to look at the granting of certain leaves, as I understand it. I may have the term wrong.
The cases which come to the High Court of Australia are cases which these days, for the most part, reach there by a process known as special leave. This is a filtering process. It is intended to ensure that only those cases go on appeal to the High Court which raise a matter of general importance either to the community or to the legal system. Now, there are many applications for special leave for which the applicants always contend that those criteria are fulfilled. There are, I think, running something of the order, and I may be wrong about the figures, but something of the order of about 600 a year at the moment. Now, that's an exponential increase from the number that there were when I was a member of the court. The difficulty in dealing with special leave applications, many of them being made by persons who are not legally represented, is that although there may be papers very thick and much of it could be described as dross, every now and again you find a pearl somewhere in there, and you can't be sure that there isn't a pearl somewhere in 600 by emptying pages of material. Now, these pages of material are dealt with in the first place by an analysis that is done by some of the Chief Justice's officers. But ultimately, the pages are looked at by each of the judges. Now, I don't mean each judge does 600. More likely, it would be that they would be divided into groups of two or three. So they're split up. But you don't get one judge just dealing with a case. You get a number of judges looking at the papers, as it were, a dossier. Sometimes, when the question is finally balanced as to whether there should be a grant of special leave, the matters are then listed for hearing before a full court in open session. Now, the burden of dealing with this paperwork is just crippling. And nobody sees it, apart from the registry staff and the associates, I suppose some of them are here today, and no doubt they're all burdened by the fact that their judges are trying to deal with this mass of paper. But to appoint a judge because he or she happens to have a high profile in relation to some matter of public importance, neglecting the question of whether they've got a general experience which allows them to deal with this mass of material that comes through special leave would be a miscarriage. So that's what the leave situation is. I'm sorry, I'm getting to Alzheimer's. What's the second question?
The second one was that you referred several times to loss of confidence.
Oh, loss of confidence. Yeah.
It's almost a motherhood statement.
Yeah.
What in practice does it mean?
What does it mean? I think perhaps the best example... No, I won't give you that example. I'll think of another one. It's too close to home. Let's take, if you can remember back this far, the Communist Party dissolution case. I know that's been in the media lately, but I'm not using it for that purpose. Now, that was a case in which political opinion was obviously very clearly divided. Indeed, there was a political campaign, on the question of the passage of that legislation. Ultimately, the High Court, by majority, held that the legislation was ultra vires, against the Constitution, was invalid. Now, certainly, there was disappointment in some quarters about the decision of the High Court in that case. I don't think there was any doubt at all that the validity of the reasoning in that case meant that the court's judgment was accepted. It was accepted generally as being a judgment which the court, applying the rule of law, was entitled to make and correctly made. Or, if you like, take the bank nationalisation case. Again, a matter of political controversy. And once again, both in the High Court and then, as circumstances then provided, in the Privy Council, again, the decision of the courts was accepted as being the appropriate decision. I'm not sure that cases of controversy today, for example, the Thomas case, are as happily or as readily accepted as they once were. Somehow or other, there seems to be a thought, oh, well, maybe they're just doing some other sort of job. They're not really applying the law. I can only say that after a lifetime of experience in the courts, I've got no doubt that the judges are applying the law. They are applying it by applying the judicial method of reasoning. And that is what is so critical to the appointment of judges. You have to have people who are experienced in the law, not only technicians who know the various statutes and cases and so forth, but who understand the principles that underlie the various rules. And especially in the High Court, that's essential, where you're dealing now with the highest court for Australia. It wasn't so until, 1986, when the last ties were cut with the Privy Council. But now the High Court has that responsibility of ensuring that the law is applicable for Australia and from time to time. And I think when there is any lack of confidence in the quality of the judges who are going to be appointed, you then make the decisions of those judges much more open to controversy. It was Alexander Hamilton in 1788, writing in The Federalist, who pointed out that the judicial branch of government is the least dangerous. It hasn't got the power of the sword, it hasn't got the power of the purse. It's got only the power of judgment. Unless the reasonings of the court are accepted generally by the public, it doesn't have a power base. So you need to have judges who can express these values in a not only coherent but convincing way. And if you have that, then you have public confidence. Without it, you have them, I think, without any power base at all. And that is dangerous for the rule of law.
Graham McAfee is my name. I'd like to ask a question in regards to, as you say, the rule of law. What happens if the government of the day brings in laws to abolish the rule of law and substitute the divine right of kings in determining justice as it should be? I'm thinking particularly of laws where that enable somebody on the government's behalf to kidnap a 3 or 4 year old girl and put her in an electrified cage and leave her there until her parents agree to sign over their rights to refugee status in Australia under refugee conventions, and the government leaves them there until they cave in under the stress of seeing their daughter become catatonic with no redress legally, because the High Court has decided that that law is perfectly legal. That's one position. The other position is, if you do take an activist position and intervene on behalf of justice, not on behalf of the law, in administering the laws of the Commonwealth, that opens the door for the Fiji and Thai type situations, where the military decides that it knows better than the legislators. So do you have any opinion on resolving that dilemma between, if you're allowed to override idiotic legislators, does that open the door for other people to follow suit, and do you think that would be a dangerous precedent or a welcome precedent in regards to justice?
Well, I can only say I hope that poor little girl doesn't get dandruff. I think the question, if I might say so, is malposed. And it's malposed for this reason. The question that will always be before the High Court is whether the particular piece of legislation is within the Commonwealth's legislative power or not. That's where it starts and that's where it finishes. It's all very well speaking about activism as though it gives the judges some discretion about all these things, that they're charges on white horses who are going off into the wild blue yonder. That is not so. The whole nature of the judicial process is that while it is not always hidebound to follow the exact words of an earlier precedent, for example, it is bound, so far as statute is concerned and so far as constitution is concerned, to follow the language of the legislature. Now, the question of whether a law is within the legislative power is resolved according to a legal method. That is, as they say, constrained by precedent, by the methodology of judicial reasoning, which is logical, and sometimes by analogy if there's no direct proposition to govern it. You don't have these wild swings of discretion that are so oftentimes said to be the judicial process. So that if the legislation is within power, it's within power. If it's not within power, it's invalid. The notion that somehow or other there are great big opportunities for judges to do justice otherwise than according to what the law is mistaken. The law has to provide some leeway for justice in particular areas where leeway is appropriate. But in terms of whether or not a piece of legislation is within the constitutional power, that's a matter which is governed strictly by the legal considerations. That may not, I suppose, be very convincing to somebody who hasn't done it, if I might say so. But I can only say that having been party to some judgments which were said to be activist, but having taken part in those judgments by the reading of cases or the reading of statutes or the reading of the Constitution, and thinking of the background at which those statutes or constitution were enacted, and applying the method, the logical method of reasoning, which is so much at the heart of judicial process, I just can't understand the notion of activism if it isn't the notion that somehow or other you do look to see whether or not just results are open. That doesn't mean that you can depart from the law, you can't. I'm sorry if that's not convincing, but that's the best I can do.
Last question.
So, Gerard, before coming to the question I want to ask, can I just say in relation to the last two questions that I think one of the finest and most scholarly judgments in recent times is clearly the judgment of the Chief Justice in the Mabo decision, and it is unfortunate that so many who don't like the outcome have responded by denigrating the court rather than by analysing the reasoning. But my question, Sir Gerard, goes to your comments about a more structured process, and in particular for the development of criteria. And I think I understood you to say that the sort of committees involved in the structured process would have a, or would be responsible for the development of the criteria. And it is with that proposition that I have a reservation. And my reservation is this. You will know that for some years I was involved in advising governments on appointments, and that was many years ago when there were very few women on the court. And judges used to say to me, appointments should only be made on merit and not on a gender basis. Some years later, when a number of women had been appointed, a number of those same judges came to me and said they were wrong. They said the appointment of women had changed the culture of the court. And by that I understood them to mean, amongst other things, that it enabled the court better to apply the social values of the community. Now, the appointment of women was done by decision of the executive, and I wonder whether a committee of the kind that I think you have recommended would be as attuned to those sorts of needs as an executive might be. And for that reason, I wonder whether there shouldn't be a larger role for the executive in relation to the criteria for appointment.
Thank you. Thank you for a number of your comments. This, I think, is the reason why, under our provision of Section 72(1), it is desirable to leave the ultimate selection to the executive government, because there is an area of discretion here which need not be just merely political, or not in any party political sense, but can be in a wider sense, designed to achieve a desirable result in the constitution of the judicial body. But as to the suitability of a judicial commission to develop the criteria, I think the English experience is instructive. Recently, the Lord Chancellor, the Lord Chief Justice, and the President of the Judicial Commission in England have produced a paper on diversity. It was their work which is designed to achieve greater diversity in the constitution of the British judiciary. And if you have a committee which contains not only lawyers, but indeed perhaps a majority of lay people who are interested in the legal process but have some knowledge about it, I think you probably have the prospect of an input that will ensure that you aren't, as it were, going to produce judicial clones in the next generation. I can't think of a better method than having those who are, A, knowledgeable in relation to the work of the courts, and B, those who have an interest in the works of the courts, as the people to create the criteria that are needed. And indeed, provided the statute directs a requirement of consideration of diversity, developing even the criteria for consideration of those elements.
Well, on that note, we will conclude. Please join me in thanking our lecturer for a very stimulating lecture.
Thank you very much.
The questions provided you with good opportunities anyway.